Our guest today on Meet the Press is the new Speaker of the House of Representatives, Carl Albert, Democrat of Oklahoma. Speaker Albert, a Rhodes Scholar, has served 24 years in the House of Representatives. He was Majority Leader for the past 9 years. We'll have the first questions now from Lawrence E. Spivak, regular member of the Meet the Press panel.
Mr. Speaker, I'm sure you know there's been a great deal of speculation about the kind of speaker you're going to be. And the predictions range from weak and permissive to very strong. Can you give us some idea of how you view your job as speaker?
Well, I view my job as speaker as being that of trying to lead the Congress in the legislative solution of problems which should be dealt with in the legislative field, problems that confront the nation. I think that's my primary job. I also think that it's my job to be the party leader and to be the presiding officer of the House.
Now, you've been in the House of Representatives for 24 years, and you've been one of its leaders, I believe, for 9 years, and few people know it as well as you do. Are you satisfied with the way it operates, or does it need more reform in your judgment?
Well, I always see room for reform in nearly everything that comes along. I think, on the whole, the House has done a very good job. I think we were expeditious last year, for instance, much more so than the country realized. We have enacted important reform bills last year, and the caucus has stood up to certain areas which I think required reform.
Am I to understand from what you say that you have no special reform that you now think is important to make the House more responsive to the needs of this country at the present time?
Well, I have certain ideas, but I want to approach them after consultation with a lot of members. I do think we can speed the tempo of the House some, for instance.
Now, do you, as Speaker, now have all the power you need to do the best possible job, or do you think that you need some more powers?
Well, I don't think I need any more powers. I, of course, supported the 21-day rule, which the House rejected. That would have given me power, but I didn't want it for the sake of power. I wanted it because I wanted to be sure and that the Congress could meet its responsibility, the House could meet its responsibilities at all times.
Well, now, do you think, now that you fail to get that, that Congress may not be able to meet all its responsibilities?
No, I think we will be able to do that.
I don't think
it's that important.
You don't believe that it's a serious handicap to the operation of the House?
No, not a major handicap. I don't think so.
Mr. Speaker, I have one more question. In a recent Gallup poll, 79% of American college students and 63% of the general public said that our political system doesn't respond quickly enough to meet the needs of the people. Why, you seem to be quite satisfied with the way the House of Representatives responds.
I'm never fully satisfied, but I think the House does a better job than most people think it does. And I think it's going to do a better job. We've got a new Congress. We've got a new day. And I believe the House of Representatives will live up to its responsibilities, but only time can tell. And I'm sure that I, for one, will be measured by the extent to which it does live up to its responsibilities.
You've just met Lawrence Spivak. The other questioners on our panel today are Neil McNeil of Time Magazine, Tom Wicker of the New York Times, and Norman Miller of the Wall Street Journal. We'll continue the questions now with Mr. McNeil.
Mr. Speaker, as the Speaker of the House, do you see yourself as a partisan political leader, party leader?
Well, I think one of the functions of the Speaker is to lead his party. I don't think that's the total function, but I think it is the responsibility of the Speaker to try to put over legislation in the national interest. And my party, as does the other party, has platforms and convictions in that direction.
Your predecessors as Speaker were reluctant to go on national television. Does your appearance on this program signal a view on your part that you, as the leader of the House and as a party leader, We'll be going to the people, the voters, on the political issues, through television and other media?
I plan to go on at reasonable intervals of time during the next 2 years.
You've said that you and the Democratic Congress won't oppose President Nixon's legislative program for the sake of opposition. How do you see that program faring, the six-point program he laid down in his State of the Union address?
Well, it's difficult to quarrel with most of the points made, the 6 points made by the president, because they were couched in very general terms. I'd like to see the specifics of the proposals before I made a judgment on any, a complete judgment on any one of them. The first one, I think, was the welfare and Social Security amendments. To show you my own thinking about that, it's a part of the unfinished business of the last Congress. I marked that bill H.R. 1. It's the number one bill on my list of priorities for early consideration.
Mr. Wicker?
Mr. Speaker, when Congress opened this year, the seniority and party status of 5 members from Mississippi was challenged because those members neither ran on the Democratic Party ticket nor supported the official ticket that had been approved by the Democratic Convention, of which you were chairman, and the Democratic National Committee. Why didn't you support the challenge to the party status and seniority of those 5 members?
Because they presented themselves with certificates of election as Democrats. They had served as Democrats in the previous Congress, and although there's some dispute as to what is the official party in the state of Mississippi, I don't think we had the obligation to go behind what they brought with them. That's my feeling.
The official party in the state of Mississippi is the party certified, one would think, by the Democratic National Committee and the Democratic Convention. And these men did not run on that party ticket. So the question arises whether Democratic Party performance in an election really has anything to do with whether a man's a Democrat in the House.
They ran on the only party they could run on as Democrats. That is my understanding, and I was given that by a number of individuals who had studied the matter. But I don't think the National Committee necessarily writes the rules for the caucus of the Democratic Party in the House of Representatives, although I support the platform. But there are many things in the platform that most Democrats, several things that most Democrats don't support. Some support some support others.
Well, sir, one of the Democrats involved in that challenge, so-called Democrats involved in that challenge, was Chairman Comer of the Rules Committee. But that challenge was defeated. Also, the rule that would have limited his power somewhat as Chairman of the Rules Committee was defeated. Now, in that sense, isn't the Speaker's head somewhat in the jaws of the lion on the Rules Committee, because they refused to limit Mr. Comer's ability in 2 ways now, at the opening of Congress?
Well, they admitted him. There was no question about his being elected to Congress, and he had presented himself as a Democrat. He has been a very cooperative chairman. I didn't support the 21-day rule because of Mr. Comer. I supported it because I think in principle it is correct that no individual or no committee or group of members of a committee should be able ever to thwart major legislation. I don't think it would have been used three or four times, maybe none this year had we had it.
Mr. Speaker, would you explain the 21-day rule? There may be some viewers not familiar with what it is.
Well, the 21-day rule simply provides, and the way the resolution was drawn this year was a little different from those in previous years, that after a period of 10 days, a rule has been requested, and the Rules Committee doesn't act or give notice of acting, a discharge can be filed, a discharge of the Rules Committee can be filed, and within 21 days, the chairman of the committee, if recognized by the Speaker, can call the bill up at him.
You can keep the Rules Committee from sitting on a bill.
Yes.
Mr. Miller?
Mr. Speaker, the system of seniority, the selection of committee chairmen according to strict seniority, has been in effect in Congress for about 60 years now. And last week, the Democrats relaxed these rules somewhat to make it possible for the general party membership to vote on the selection of chairman. Do you believe that these new rules should now be invoked to oust any of the present chairman of the House?
No.
Why not, Mr. Chairman? There is this general, or Mr. Speaker, there is this general criticism that the chairman of the House are very aged, averaging in age about 70 years, and therefore unresponsive to the needs and desires of the country. Do you believe that that criticism is unjustified?
I don't believe we should discriminate on the basis of age if constituents don't. I don't know how old Mr. Spivak is, but he's about the sharpest questioner I've seen around in a long time.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you intend, as Speaker, to lay down a legislative program of specific bills and then ask the chairman to report out such bills?
We have a general program, and I will have more to say about that later on.
Could you give us any of the specific elements of that program?
Most of them are well known. They're matters dealing with the problems that haunt the country or the problems that require solution. But before I make a statement on that subject matter, I'm going to call in the various committee chairmen and discuss it with them.
Mr. Spivak?
Mr. Chairman, before we start, I'd like to point out that I do surround myself with a great many questioners who are a good deal younger than I am. We're not all my age. May I ask you this question? What do you see as the most serious and immediate problem facing the new Congress?
Well, I think it depends on what angle you look at it. I think the most immediate legislative problem is not just one problem, it's several problems dealing with the economy. I think there's another problem, and you touched on it a while ago, and that is trying to give the House and the Senate, and I'm interested, of course, primarily in the House, an image before the country that will cause the country to respect it, respect its judgments and its attitudes and its work. I think that's very important. I think this is so basic. This institution is so basic to our country that the people need to understand it and to respect it. And, of course, members of Congress need to help give it that image if they can.
Yeah, but why do you think Congress has lost the respect of the people? What has it done? Hasn't it done something?
I don't know whether it's lost the respect. I'm not sure that in all the history of democratic political institutions, the people don't generally question their elected officials. I think that's probably been true through most of the years of the country's history. There probably was one or two times, and Mr. McNeil is a better authority on this than I am, when the legislative branch was preeminent over the executive branch. That's difficult to do in this day and age because the president is the one chosen individual of the nation.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I think the big criticism that is being made against Congress is that it isn't responsive. Now, I'd like to take up a very specific thing on the issue of responsiveness. According to a recent Gallup poll, 77% of the American people are in favor of having the federal government collect taxes and return a percentage to the states without strings. Now, as I understand it, you're against that. Now, why?
I am not against that if there are proper limitations, but I am not going to endorse that proposal until it's spelled out, because I am not in favor of the federal government becoming only a tax-collecting agency for the states and municipalities without any conditions, turning money over to incompetent administrations, if there are some, and I'm sure there are some. I think we're morally obligated if we send a tax collector to somebody to see that the money is properly spent.
Well, you've given the localities, Congress has voted the localities something like $27 billion with all sorts of strings attached to them. It hasn't done much good. Don't you think it's time to give some thought to changing that system?
I think it's time to give some thought to changing the system, but I think this thing needs to be studied in much greater depth than any study I've seen up to now.
How long, Mr. Chairman?
Well, I think it should be studied just as long as necessary to get the job done. For instance, I think that Congress is entitled to know how the communities and the states are spending their own funds, how far they're going in meeting their own responsibilities to tax their own constituencies. All of these are relevant to this issue.
Mr. Speaker, one more question. The president has proposed a revolutionary reorganization of government. How much chance is there that Congress will pass that? Well, what do you think the House will do?
I don't know, but I told the president that I would go to the appropriate committees and ask them to give it full consideration, and that I will do. It will be difficult to pass. I'm sure the president is under no illusions about that, because various groups are represented in the cabinet as we have it constituted now. You have a Department of Agriculture, you have a Department of Labor, you have a Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. And these are wide areas of interest in the United States, and you're going to have a lot of group lobbying if you go too far in burying these major interests of America into cabinet positions that don't seem to represent them. But I do think there's a lot of merit in the president's proposal in general, but I want to see the specifics, frankly.
Mr. McNeil?
Mr. Speaker, we have a divided government now between the two parties, and both the president and the leaders of Congress have been talking about working in a cooperative partnership. Well, a half dozen Democrats running for president in the Senate. Is that possible?
Well, I think so. None of the leaders of the Senate, so far as I know, are running for president, and every senator and every congressman has his own views and his own right to run for other offices. I don't see where this will be a major factor, but I'm speaking mainly for the House, Mr. McNeil. I think we will cooperate with the president whenever we think his suggestions are sound.
Yes, well, off the last November's election and the stiff Nixon-Agnew campaign against the Democratic Congress, yes, how much possibility do you see of a cooperative effort now? Are there resentments left from that?
Well, I think we're good winners. I think you'll have cooperation. I really believe that the Congress, the overwhelming majority of the members of Congress, want to cooperate if it's in the national interest. I think some have some doubt as to whether a Republican administration can, in view of the nature of modern America, with its traditional philosophies, really meet the responsibilities of this generation. I think a lot of Americans believe that.
You don't see the danger, then, of a political confrontation and a divided, stalemated government?
No, I don't see that. I think this year we can work together, but we're not going to accept things from the White House just because they're sent up, but we're not going to oppose things from the White House just because a Republican president sends them up.
Mr. Wicker?
Returning to the question of seniority, Mr. Speaker, you said that you didn't think that Congress should discriminate on the basis of age if constituencies didn't. I agree with that, although there's a constitutional prohibition against being too young to serve. But the question is not on the membership of the House. The question is on the chairmanships of committees. And it seems to me that it would be entirely within the prerogatives of the House to make its own decision as to how old chairmen should be, not members of the House. Now, why, when every major company and all other branches of the federal government require retirement at age 65, shouldn't the House require retirement of chairman at age 65, or even 70?
If I'm not mistaken, the Supreme Court has some members older than any member of the House of Representatives.
Agreed. That's a pertinent exception, but my question remains as far as why should House members be exempt on that?
There's no age limit, so far as I know, on the President of the United States, on cabinet officers. Only those in bureaucratic positions, only the hired help, have age limitations placed on them. The leaders of the country and all branches of the government, so far as I know, have no legal or other inhibitions placed on them so far as age is concerned. And some of our most active chairmen are some of our older chairmen.
So you would not favor, then, a retirement age for chairmen of House committees That is, even one that might have certain exceptions,
Well, not age alone. Of course, if someone becomes inept, if he loses his ability to perform, then that's another matter. But that might be true whether based on age or infirmity.
We have about 3 minutes left, gentlemen. Mr. Miller?
Mr. Speaker, what may this Congress do by way of programs aimed at reducing the 6% unemployment rate?
Well, we would like very much to expand government programs. We would like to see wage and price guidelines, if not controls, put in. We would like to see us face up to the problems of the environment, the preservation of our resources and the development of our resources. It's a good time to do those things. First, they're badly needed, and secondly, we are going from a wartime to a peacetime economy. And I think this is a good time to start channeling funds. And I'm glad the President said in his State of the Union message that he was going to have a full employment budget or an expansionary budget, but I can't tell much difference between that and a Democratic deficiency budget.
Mr. Spivak?
Mr. Speaker, according to reports, one of the first bills introduced into the House is to ban the use of funds for air or sea combat support for any military operations in Cambodia. How much chance is there that that will pass in the House?
Well, air or sea combat support, I think that if it goes to the question of getting our troops out and protecting them on the way out, it wouldn't have any chance. If it should go to the question of widening the war, it would be adopted.
Well, are you yourself in favor of the specific legislation that was introduced?
I haven't seen that legislation. I'm sorry, Mr. Spivak. I haven't seen the bill.
Mr. Speaker, you were recently quoted as predicting that there will be sharp clashes between the Nixon administration and the Democratic leadership on domestic policy. Why do you expect sharp clashes?
Well, I expect, just on the basis of the record, that we will disagree. But I am repeating that I have said over and over again, we're not going to disagree for the sake of disagreement.
Mr. McNeil?
Mr. Speaker, do you see any chance of Congress passing something like temporary wage and price controls as a means to halting inflation?
Well, I think it would be futile unless we had the administration's cooperation. We have given the President standby wage and price controls, and I think that expires March the 31st, and it will probably be extended.
In your judgment, has President Nixon done enough to stop inflation?
No.
Mr. Wicker?
Mr. Speaker, the Senate has a constitutional function in foreign affairs, just as the House has a constitutional function in taxation.
Right.
For that reason, the House has been accused under both your predecessors, I think, as being something of a rubber stamp for presidents in the area of foreign affairs.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Mr. Wickham, but time is up. Thank you very much, Speaker Albert, for being with us today on Meet the Press. Thank you.